Blog Talk Radio.
Peace, Bargani, Salam, Islam, Salama, Gino Lacko, Minani, Keith Noble, Bandele, back again on the airwaves, and we're coming back for part two of our series dealing with rites of passage and child support and the whole nine. If you listen to last week's show, we dealt with the necessity of rites of passage and how we need to implement a indigenous, melanated African rites of passage into our family and into our community for the fact that it will help protect your rights. So if you didn't get to hear that show, we're not going to go back into it, but you can check that show on the archives. If you go to, you know, Indigenous People Radio, you'll be able to hear all our backlogs. And there are other backlogs we got that won't be on there long. So if you want to check those out too, please do. But we're going to have King El Bay on. He'll probably be joining me in a few minutes. But until that time, wanted to discuss the a couple things as far as what we got going on. Brother King El Bay has written a book on how to stop child support, and it's a very comprehensive book on steps on how to combat excessive child support or different things, like, you know, a lot of times child support may be more than what you actually have or can actually afford to make. So it helps, you know, reducing child support or even stopping it. But in no way is this a way to stop deadbeat dads or whatever, to stop pay child support. This is really for incidences where people are being abused by child support, which goes on a lot. And also check out my new book, The Indigenous Treaties, the Moors and Moorish Treaties, dealing with the Melanated Indigenous Treaties. So I'm dealing with more than just your Moorish Treaty. I'm dealing with treaties that come from Americas with the indigenous Aboriginal, and I'm also dealing with Moorish Treaties and what we consider African or African, not, won't say African American, but Africans in America, Afro-American treaties, which a lot of people are not familiar with, but they also have treaties too. So I want you to check those out. Both of those books can be found on Amazon. So I see my brother's on, about to click him on. Yo, peace, peace, God, you there?
Peace, my brother, peace.
Peace, man. Just filling them in real quick before you got on. Let them know about the books we got out and the work we're doing. So, you know, I know we don't got a lot of time, but we want to try to get as much as we can in on the rites of passage and kind of pick up, guess where we left off, man. You know, I was kind of recapping just a tad, but I really wanted to go into the child support, man, because I know you've been posting a lot of information, a lot of good information on Facebook. And for those who ain't following him, he's King El Bay on Facebook, so, you know, check him out and follow him. But he's dropping a lot of information about that, you know, about child support. And so I wanted to get into that a little bit more, man. I know we didn't get into the creditor thing, so maybe I wanted to talk a little bit about the creditor and debtor, kind of explain to people what you mean by that and how it applies to child support.
Okay, now you got to understand the contract clause of the Constitution and how we have a limited right to contract. When we're dealing with child support everything in the United States starts on a commercial side or a commercial venue. So it deals with contracts. So child support, when you're dealing with the birth certificate and how everything is generated, it starts off with that affidavit of birth. That affidavit of birth is then stimulated into birth, creates birth certificates. Then it goes to the central birth, the central paternity registry. They put it in there, the vital statistics, and also it gets filtered into the vital statistics, and that the United States take that birth certificate, that contract. So when we talk about terms like obligor, obligee, those are commercial terms that stimulate a commercial venue in which they utilize these terms to put you into their jurisdiction, because they assume personal jurisdiction over you when you're doing commercial business within the realms of the state that you're living in. So that's where they come in with dealing with commerce. Now, on the other end, the federal level, they deal on in interstate commerce. Commerce that's actually in between states. Commerce that's being transported from one state to another. That's how the federal jurisdiction gets stimulated. So when we're talking about the creditor and debtor, there's only two positions on the commercial side. There is the creditor and there is the debtor. The debtor is the person obligated to the creditor. And the creditor in the commercial realm, he is the person that's affording the debtor any type of credit that he needs to be able to perform anything that the debtor needs. So when you go, when you cross back over to the legal side of things, the creditor is always in position to win. So the creditor always have all the rights when you're dealing with that. So just trying to break that down from the child support standpoint, they put us in the debtor position so that we'll always be obligated through that contract to pay the creditor. So that's why they can go and enforce a judgment against us.
Okay. So let me ask you this. So everything is debtor or creditor. Is the obligee and the obligor a credit and debtor themselves? Or
this is the tricky part. What they did was they gave the mother parental rights. Parental rights, that's all she has. When you are when you have an estate, your children are part of that estate or their heirs. There's no such thing as parental rights. They are part of that estate. That estate protect their rights. So what they did, they transferred or gave the mother only parental rights, but they took the position as creditor and then made the mother the custodial parent, meaning that she only has rights and supervisions to care for the child as parental rights to help raise the child, but they are essentially the creditor and supposed to provide all the needs for the child. And then the father is supposed to be the non-custodial parent if they're not married, and he takes the position. Also, he pays the position as the non-custodial parent, but he's the debtor. The mother is not the debtor. She is the custodian, the keeper of the property. She's just the keeper of the property.
Wow.
So
a lot of women,
they allow
thinking
her,
they... Go ahead.
Well, she's just the keeper of the property, but she's what she's doing, they saying, okay, we're going to allow you to act on position for the benefit for the creditor. So the mother has the right to enforce her creditor. She's not technically the creditor. She's acting on the behalf of the creditor as well as the child support agency because she is technically the custodian. So by her being the custodian and acting on the behalf of the creditor, you as the debtor is forced to pay the custodian for keeping such state property.
Got you. So what I was going to say, I guess, was that a lot of the mothers think that when they got the custodial right, that they have full rights over the child. But that's not necessarily true. You're saying that they only a custodial, meaning they take care of the child, but the true, I guess, owner of the child, if you will, is really the state.
Yes. They're part of the estate of whatever state you're in. That's why they only can. That's why children can't do no kind of commerce until they get 18. And the children. That's why children can get all types of free. That's why education is free for children. Mothers can get free benefits for children if she qualified based upon her income. Children qualify for all types of things just because they're children.
Okay.
And that's why the state saying, hey, we're going to make sure the children are safe. We're going to make sure that the children have what they need. And if the mother can't provide those needs, they will step in automatically and assure that the children are taken care of.
Okay, so that leads me right into the other thought. something that you posted today on Facebook where you were saying that a woman or a man can get welfare benefits and do not have to put the other child or the other parent on child support due to their religious beliefs. Okay, using like what you say a good cause waiver form. So could you kind of explain that?
Well, good cause shown is actually is a term that is used that you can show to waive such condition to put the other parent on child support. And that is that also swing both ways also. And you can use your religious rights to say that you don't practice such actions based upon whatever reasons. Some women may even use it just if there's, in the case of domestic violence, they don't want their baby father to know or their child father to know where they're located or other issues. But you can also use a religion as a stimulus to activate such application.
Got you. And I'm looking at, let's see, what is it? Because we're in Ohio, we're looking at the revised code. It's 5101.
That's the administrative codes. See,
okay.
A lot of people, you got to understand, the state codes are related to state and government actions in which can be stimulated. But you also can look at you need to understand the functionality of that administrative agency based on the administrative codes to determine what their primary functions is and how they operate. So you got to get familiar with a lot of these agencies' administrative codes within your particular section of your state or in county city to determine what that organization, based upon its administrative codes, can perform. So if you go all the way down to that section 5101.12.10.32, you can show it talks about shelter and legal, religion, and medical and other professionals from whom a caretaker or assistant is dealing with domestic violence. But religious can always be operated, and religion is definitely protected by it's a guarantee by the Constitution within the First Amendment and in our state under Section, I believe, 6 of the Bill of Rights. So it's automatically useful, and it's also used in these administrative codes also. So you have the state protecting you, the federal protecting you, and the administration protecting you. So no one can, the state, the federal, or the administration agency can affect your religious rights. And you need to understand that, and that give you better protection when all three agencies or forms of government explain that they will not infringe upon your religious rights. That gives you extra protection.
I see. And that was another post. Make mention that the courts remain neutral when it comes to religion and must accommodate the free exercise of religion. And I think you go to a case law where it's Lee versus Wiseman dealing with the government must remain neutral in matters of religion, does not foreclose it from ever taking religion into account. So that played back into the rites of passage. Bouncing it back off of that. When you're dealing with the fact that you have established your religious rights, I should say, they have to acknowledge that. They have to, if he might get overrides the state responsibility for the child. Is that like in the ballpark of what you know what I'm saying?
Repeat that again.
I was saying that rites of passage, if you got your religious rights in place, it kind of will override the state's responsibility on with the child.
Well, your religious rights will come into play. The state and government has not only a legal responsibility but a moral responsibility to you. So they can't just come in and infringe on your well-being, on your morals. So they have to protect, they guarantee that they will protect your moral standard of living. So they cannot come in there and strip you of that. That is what they call a fundamental principle, and you have to establish that. A lot of people just assume that they have this in place. No, you don't. You have to establish it, because the state is coming in from a presumption that they're exercising within their jurisdiction based upon they're exercising their right as the creditor, and they're not taking any other position due to the fact that you probably have not presented this information and established yourself so you can have legal standing. So just don't assume that you can exercise these legal rights, because you also have to put everyone on notice. People think that, hey, I could just go and exercise my religious rights. No, when you go into a particular venue or place, people, you have to alert people to who you are and what you are doing so that you don't infringe upon their rights. You don't, just because you have a right, a religious right, doesn't give you the right to infringe upon other people's rights or beliefs, because they have those same fundamental rights. But there is room, if you do it in a proper way, where it can be established and then notice is sent out, in which people have to then respect your rights and cannot encroach or take away such rights.
Okay. I got what you're saying. I'm hoping the people do too as well. Well, I mean, and then with that being said, it sounds like that religious rights are like the most fundamental principle that we can use in order to defend ourselves in any situation, you know, particularly with the rites of passage and the child support. And I really think that people don't use it correctly. Like you said, the establishing, we have to establish your rights. And that don't mean that you can just go in when you get in trouble, all of a sudden you become a Moorish American or a Hebrew Israelite or, you know, whatever it is that you may be. You can't just all of a sudden go into court and be like, ah, this is against my religious right. I'm a Moorish American. I mean, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you can't. No, this has to be well established and documented. And then what I call, you want to have as many reference points as possible so that it give the appearance that people have been placed on notice. Like, for example, if you have a trust, these religious rights should be encumbered in your trust on, so when people go and look at your trust within your state records, they can see that your religious rights is in there. So now your job is to serve people notice, to give as many people notice of what's going on with you, so they cannot say they wasn't aware of your rights. Awareness is a part of due process. It's what they call a substantive right. If you do not perform due process, then what you're asking for in your request will be denied because it's not sufficient enough to meet the due process standard. Did that make sense?
Yeah. Definitely. So when we're dealing with you know, the state trying to force you into something, let's say, like I said, one of the parents, either the mother or the father, you know, they signed the birth certificate. And that parent is trying to, you know, establish a child support order on you. And, you know, they've agreed to that jurisdiction with the state. They've agreed to allow the state to have ownership over the child. What, in your opinion, what do you do when they, when they're making that move against you? Because they've sided with the state at this point.
With the child mother?
With whoever, the child mother or the father, you know what I mean? Like, whoever is the one that's got the child, the custodial, so-called custodial parent, when they're trying to make a move against the other parent to put them on child support, if they sided with the state and you've established your religious rights, is that enough to stop the process of child support?
Well, the first thing first, remember, I talk about the commercial side. Whoever has the child must produce the contract, must produce the wedding contract that you, that they are the creditor and they can enforce the rights of the creditor. The mother is not the creditor. So she has, she's only the custodial. So they give her rights as the custodial. So you must object to the process on the basis that on the commercial side that she has to prove that she's the creditor of the estate. Now they're going to the child support agency used the Central Paternity Registry to determine acknowledgement of paternity. So all they doing is acting as a witness to confirm the mother's position. You have to do the same. You have to put in an affidavit just proving that and having them come up with the contract. And also you can put in witnesses' statements also to verify that you do not have the contract and no one has ever produced you, gave you the contract. And also they must explain to both parents what is exactly going on is that the United States is that your state is saying that they are the creditor for your child, and I guarantee neither parent was aware that exactly what was happening. So that would even further make it unconscionable and non-binding.
So let's go back. So when you saying that that you got to make the mother prove the wet ink contract, wouldn't that go back on the state to prove that?
No, you got to remember, she put in an application and a request for support
to the state, though. I mean, not
she,
to the state,
she,
but
no,
I'm saying
she went to the
contract that she's got. Right.
Right. Well, this is what happens. The state just don't put you on child support. She has to apply, right? She has to go and sign up for child support. She has to request it as an applicant.
Right.
So once she go to them, the child enforcement agency, and request child support, they start initiating the action of support. But it's all stimulated through her. So by her being the plaintiff, because you never see the state involved, the state is never in the room as prosecutor. So the mother is the prosecutor in this civil matter. So
she's
a
plaintiff. She's a plaintiff, right?
Right. So she's the prosecutor in the civil matter. So
who represents her, though?
She's representing herself.
Okay. Okay.
Child support agencies do not represent neither parent, and you will find that in their manuals.
It just seems like they do. It seems like they seem like they represent the person who is making the claim. So, and that, okay. So in our last few minutes, I know you've talked about claims and disputing a claim or defeating a claim. Can you go into that a little bit?
Okay. When we talk about defeating a claim, 9 times out of 10, someone is making a claim through an affidavit, through a complaint. And then they might have supporting information like a contract that you sign that is verified and probably been witnessed, stating that you have did that, and they have particular evidence according to that agreement. You, when defeating claims, you have to understand you have to defeat the commercial side in the state, because they're claiming that they are the creditor in all positions. So that's the first side you need to attack first and make them prove that they are the creditor to defeat the commercial side of the claim. And then when you come into court, the debtor do have rights. The debtor do have remedies, but most of the remedies are due to some type of defect or fraud relating to what the creditor had done to establish his position as creditor. So to defeat the claim, you must disprove their claim through adequate evidence by using affidavits and disputing their position as creditor and having them prove that they're actually the creditor within the state and that they have personal jurisdiction over you based upon their saying that you were doing commerce within the state. And you need to exercise your religious rights showing that you are exempt from such state obligation in the sense that you weren't doing commerce within the state jurisdiction when you're dealing with defeating the claim. So you have to understand these very positions so that you can break down these points or what they call positive and negative avertments to ensure victory when dealing with a claim.
So basically everything is dealing with a claim.
Yes, they are all claims.
Civil or criminal?
Civil or criminal.
All claims are by affidavit.
All claims are by affidavit.
Interesting. So that's very interesting because I've never, like I said, I really don't hear people speaking about it as a claim. So people, what we're saying is that the child support, when a person puts the other parent on child support, it's the claim. So you should really focus on defeating the claim through the commercial process in order to stop whatever action that they're trying to bring to you.
Right.
Is that what you're, okay. Just making sure that I'm spitting it back out. Okay.
It starts on the commercial end first, and then it comes over to the administrative side where they try to exercise it judicially to determine what rights can be enforced. Because all it is is once you make a claim, someone can enforce their rights based upon a commercial contract. So once you break up that claim and disprove any theories of that claim, there's no rights to enforce. Nothing is enforceable, and they no longer have any legal standing.
So what happens is when a person does not dispute the commercial side, then the state automatically assumes jurisdiction. Is that?
Exactly.
And nobody ever disputes the commercial side. You're saying that child support, because you looked at that, child support's in the Uniform Commercial Code, right?
Exactly.
And what is it saying, basically, in there, if you can paraphrase?
It's basically stating that it's talking about the creditor and that the child, or it says the creditor or the child support enforcement agency can enforce the rights of the creditor. If you look at it, especially if you go to my post, you have to look at that specific code as it relates to that particular jurisdiction. So I'm trying to see if I can pull it up real quick, but just to emphasize that it just pretty much identifies that it's a creditor and debtor relationship, and that the creditor can pretty much enforce the rights, that the child support agency can enforce the rights of the creditor upon the obligor.
So that's basically how they're getting over, or how they able to even, like how they even able to do a child support order, is because it is commercial.
It's commercial. It's a contract. And the both parties agree to allow the state to be the creditor for the child.
Well, that's if they sign
the
birth certificate.
That's another reason why they can take the children and lock you up for truancy. Take the children for truancy, lock you up for spanking your children and all of that, because they're assuming responsibility over the child as the creditor.
So people, this is why it's important that when you, in your rites of passage, dealing with the first right is birth. And the two parents are establishing their rites of passage with their affidavit. Because it go back to everything start with an affidavit.
Exactly.
So they can't get past their affidavit. Now, with that affidavit, does that break that transaction, that commercial transaction? Is that true? Go ahead.
The affidavit, what it does is challenge the state's position. And then it allows you to show that you have established a religious or moral doctrine or a covenant that you are planning to exercise, that both persons or parties agree to these terms, and now they're enforceable by law because y'all both established these rights to exercise.
And so they go back to what they consider minorities, because they always say we're the minority because we're not the majority of the population. But we also know that the word minority also deals with someone who is not legally able to control themselves. And so it feels like when you allow the state to dictate your birth and how the birth is perceived, it seems like it puts you into a minority role.
Exactly.
But as adults, if we're two consenting adults, if you're a male and a female and you have a child, regardless if you're married or not, being your adult, that you should be, as adults, be able to deal with your matters yourself. But when you allow the state to be involved, that shows how childish you are as parents, that you really don't have a right to the child. It's crazy.
Exactly. It just shows your competency level, because most people, when they do something, they establish themselves in society. So you would like to establish yourself in your rights. This is what goes on. This is why when you have a trust, you're establishing yourself. You're establishing your rights. You have to establish yourself, and this is what's wrong. Everybody think, hey, I can just go get a trust and do this. You still have to establish yourself. It's a lot of things. That's why the rites of passage is so important, due to the constitutions of the state and the United States guarantee they will protect that fundamental right. That's why it's so important that you entrench yourself with an organization that has a rights of passage like we do, so we can protect those rights and keep government from infringing on that. And once this is established and you know how to enforce them, you can get a declaratory judgment, and that you can take that document to any state or government entity or any establishment that does business within the state, and they will have to respect your rights.
So what is a declaratory judgment?
It's a judgment that is declared. It's nothing but a declaration that has not been defeated by a claim that you had established through the commercial side, remember, and you brought it back over to the administrative side, through the legal side, that now you have the evidence that that declaration can now be enforced based upon you have made these rights, you have established yourself through your rights of passage, and now these rights are now enforceable in full effect.
I know we don't want to get all deep into the process, but I mean, how do you establish a declaratory judgment on a commercial side?
Okay, simple. When you go through, when you UCC them on the commercial end, dealing with the UCCs, when you file a notice of protest, a notice to cure, and you go through the defaulting process, when they default on that commercial side and you provided them with your religious rights and everything on the commercial side, and they do not rebut or defeat that claim through any opposition, through other contractual relationships where they show that you relinquish such rights, then that claim will be defeated. And then you bring that back over with all the exhibits that they had defaulted, and you do it through notary presentment, and you bring it back over to the commercial side. And by it being by notary presentment, it has the full faith and credit of the United States, in which you then can get your remedy. And now you can use those documents to show and verify these records that they have defaulted and they were in dishonor, and now they didn't defeat your claim on the commercial side, and now you brought it back over to the legal side where you have a judge or a magistrate sign off on that matter. And now with your declaration of affidavit of declaratory judgment, it can now be enforced because you had established yourself and disproved and defeated their claim on the commercial side, in which you can enforce it on the legal side.
Damn, okay. That's, okay, I got you. Well, got like a minute left. Is there anything you want to say in this last minute, man? Before we jump up?
I want to say, get the book, check me out, King L. Bay, go to Amazon, go to Create Space, check out How to Stop Child Support by King L. Bay. Also, check out Bandelay's Treaties, Moore's Treaties 2 book, and check us out. We talk about these things, and we going to be the new movers and shakers because we are working real hard to get these rights of passage and establish these rights so that we can now challenge the court and have proper legal standing. No one is doing this the proper way. That's why we're trying to enforce the rights of passage from birth to death so that you can ensure the integrity and and enforce your rights within the court. So
that's right.
I just want to get everybody to understand. Come to Facebook, check us out. I'm King El Bay. Go to my Facebook. Go to Benelay Alameen.
Yep.